Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Damage Report. I am John Iadarola, joined in studio today by Francesca.
Hi.
Fiorentini, back in studio. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a little bit. We've had a midterm election. I don't know if you knew.
I'm wearing a soft powder blue to represent the kind of wave it was.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not a deep blue, just a soft powder blue.
I think you should have like some fringes that are deep blue.
Oh, right.
There are a couple individuals.
Right. We wear fringe when we talk about Alex Jones.
Exactly, which we were a minute ago. But we won't on the show, so don't worry about that. Today is going to be a very packed show because we have both a lot of news to get to. We're going to be talking about the opening weeks of the next session of Congress. What is actually on the Dem agenda? We'll be breaking that down. Amazon has announced where their new headquarters are going to be located, and not everyone representing those districts is happy about it. A big name is going to pop up there. But in addition, we also have two guests that will be joining us. So University of Arizona Professor of Law Andrew Cohen is going to be joining us to talk about the Mueller investigation, the ouster of Jeff Sessions, and what is actually likely to play out in the near future in regard to the special counsel's investigation. And then later on, early this morning, there was a protest outside of Nancy Pelosi's office. Climate protesters and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And TYT investigates, or Rebel HQ's Emma Vigeland was there, interviewed AOC, and she will be joining us near the close of the show to talk about that as well. So obviously lots to get to, and we're also going to be talking about your new podcast.
Indeed.
Very exciting. And I'm excited that I will actually be able to say the name on here. It actually fits within our language requirements, apparently.
Yes, it does.
So find out why that was a concern later on. Anyway, let's start off with something both serious and fun. What will the Democrats actually be doing with their new House majority when they take control of it in the very near future? Well, there is some indication coming out of what will be on the top of their agenda. And apparently some pro-worker policies, at least supposedly, are going to be there. House Democratic aides involved in labor policy discussions say there are two specific issues near the top of the list: raising the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $15 an hour within the next few years, and expanding overtime pay to millions more workers. The particular way that they might be doing the former is the Raise the Wage Act, which gradually raises the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour within 7 years, and then would tie the minimum wage to median wage growth for the overall workforce, which is not quite the same thing as cost of living increase, but it is at least something considering it doesn't, you know, adapt at
median
all now.
Median wage growth.
Yeah, okay. Which we know the medium wage growth has been great.
Over
the last few decades.
don't peg it to that, but I don't, in perpetuity, if it were a real, like, depends on who the plan is coming from, but don't just in perpetuity that second part of it. But the first part sounds very promising.
It does. I mean, it is one thing to say over a few years and another to say over 7 years. For me, seven is not a few. It's 2.5 fews. But it is at least something, and it is a jumping off point. Now, we do have to acknowledge that they have the House. They don't have the Senate. And this is something that would benefit not CEOs, it would benefit the workers. So it's unlikely to actually pass. But still important that they do this sort of thing. And we're going to have some other details as well. If you were in charge, what agenda would you actually set for the first few days? How would you take this new House majority and make, you know, the most of it?
Neutering of every male congressman. I forgot what show I was on. The interesting thing that has been happening now in Congress, right? I don't know what I would do, but we see where progressives in Congress are going, right? Something not everyone knows about is that there is a Congressional Progressive Caucus that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is now part of. They, every year, put out a budget. They put out priorities. Hey, let's reduce military spending by this much. Let's increase healthcare spending, assistance for veterans, or help with the VA. Like, they put out a really progressive budget every single year. And I think we on the left kind of tend to imagine that people in Congress aren't doing that hard work, but they are. It's just that they don't have clout and seniority in Congress. Well, they have seniority, but they don't, they're not Pelosi or Schumer, right? Those two are not on the Congressional Progressive Caucus. AOC is. She had watching her Instagram story, she had a pre-orientation to be part of the CPC. So I think we have to take our cues from them, and I'm sure it's going to be around expanding Medicare, protecting Medicare, and raising the minimum wage. I'm interested to see what, you know, people like Pelosi and Schumer, how they respond to that.
Yeah, and in addition to the seniority, which is important, also, I would argue that in the past they haven't had much media that gave a damn what they were working on.
Exactly.
Like, they could have a budget, okay, but if nobody ever hears about it outside of the caucus, then it doesn't really get much traction. I'm hoping, I mean, look, they've got us and other online media outlets. I'm hoping that some of the mainstream media, if only to provide a contrast to Donald Trump and the Republicans, might now be willing to actually do it. After reporting on, you know, baby theft and Muslim bans for 2 years, hey, let's talk about something a little bit more optimistic. There's actually people pushing for positive change for actual Americans. That would be great. I don't know if I should really get my hopes up there, but that would be great. Some other things that they're attempting to work on, that same law that we were talking about, the Raise the Wage Act, would also phase out the lower minimum wage for restaurant servers and other tipped workers, which is currently $2.13 an hour, which I used to make. And employers would no longer be allowed to pay some disabled workers less than the minimum wage. House Democrats also plan to use their oversight power to investigate some controversial moves by the Department of Labor, including efforts to allow employers to keep workers' tips and to permit teens to do more hazardous work in apprenticeship programs. Yeah, the keeping the workers' tips thing was the most blatantly pro-management move I think I've seen out of the Department of Labor, that they can just rob the servers that they're managing. And it got a little bit of media coverage, but unfortunately, like, obviously people who make the tips care about that, but it didn't really get a lot of traction outside of that.
No, and that the tipped wage workers eliminating the lower sort of like that $2.13 minimum wage for tipped workers is huge. If that happened nationally, that would mean so much for working people, especially women in the workforce, in the restaurant industry. And the Restaurant Opportunity Center has been working all over this country on ballot measures and on in state assemblies to pass something similar to that, and they've had some successes. But if they did it nationally, that would mean a lot. And this is the whole thing, I think we forget, for those people who never worked in the restaurant industry, for example, California and New York, the minimum wage for a restaurant worker is the same minimum wage as anything else, right? But people still tip 15-20%. But you know, you go to a place like, I don't know, Iowa, or I'm just gonna name a random state, which I imagine doesn't have that.
We don't know for sure.
We don't know for sure, fact check. But you know, $2.13 an hour is pitiful. And then of course, if you allow, or if it's easy for your employer to keep your tips for you, like, that's, it's ripe for sexual assault and
harassment.
Exactly.
Yeah. And understand, as someone who worked for tips for a number of years, that $2.13 an hour becomes zero because you just pay your taxes on, like, effectively all the taxes on your tips just get deducted out of that, which means at the end of the week, you literally get no paycheck whatsoever, or, you know, $3 or something like that. So this would be a good change as well. So I did ask my followers on Twitter what they would want to be the first bill put forward by House Democrats now that they have the majority. And I was surprised both by some of the things that were suggested, but also the diversity of different things. There were a lot of concerns. I mean, some things popped up most often. This is based on a statistical analysis that I did by just casually browsing through. So Medicare for All was probably the most common. $15 an hour minimum wage was right up there. Similarly, I would say drastic action on climate change, like the Green New Deal, was actually, thankfully, and that might be just because they're my followers that they care so much about that. I hope that Americans generally do. But what was interesting is there was also a lot of talk of, like, protecting the Mueller investigation, investigating Donald Trump. That wasn't, you know, in the top five necessarily, but it was commonly coming up. It's something that I think gets derided quite a bit, but at least on political Twitter, which I constantly point out is representative of nothing but political Twitter, that is a thing that people are thinking about.
No, I think that's, listen, I think it's about offense and defense. And I think you have to have some offense, you have to have a positive vision, hence, you know, reforms around climate change. I would also want to see gun reform in there. I think this week has been heinous in terms of, you look at Thousand Oaks suffering, you know, a murderer who killed 12 people. Then that evening of the vigil, people are evacuating from climate change induced or, you know, bolstered climate change, forest fire, excuse me. So But then the defense, you know, you got to actually hold the president accountable. And now that the House and Democrats are in a position to do so, I want to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have to remember, of course, you know, the Tree Life synagogue shooting, which, I mean, so we only can hold one shooting really in our head. Like, I'm going to forget the one that came before that. But that was like 8 days ago. Yeah. Like, it was not a long time ago. And in terms of, I'm glad that you said offense, defense. There are some people who say, I don't think you should talk about X topic because that will not sway voters in the next election. That is not the only reason you pursue something, yeah, whether publicly or behind closed doors. There's a lot of things that we got to get done. And it is not going to be determined just by what some people in a diner in Iowa think is the most important topic.
I think we have to stop thinking in this, like, what's going to isolate people? What's a losing issue? You know, and sort of like only relying on polls and only, I think it's, yeah, a package. It's a complete vision. And what is the Democrats and what is a progressive vision that encompasses all of these things?
Yeah, exactly. You can do both. You don't have to, you know, like, for instance, we're going from our first block is the fight for increased minimum wage.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The second block is going to be protecting the Mueller investigation. Proof that you can do both. Anyway, with that said, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we have a professor of law who's going to be joining us. Recently wrote an article about how important public reaction to the firing of Jeff Sessions will be for the future of the special counsel's investigation after this. So Jeff Sessions was pushed out about a week ago, and hey, it's been a week and the Mueller investigation hasn't been shut down. That is amazing. But will it in the near future? Joining us now to break down what might happen, Andrew Cohan, professor of law at the University of Arizona. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Very glad to have you here. So I read your article about sort of executive power and the influence of public opinion reaction to the exertion of executive power. For those who haven't seen it, can you explain sort of your thesis as how it relates to Jeff Sessions' ouster?
So I've written a book about the history of special prosecutors, and I think the most important lesson that history teaches us in this area is that special prosecutors are incapable of saving us from ourselves. If the president wants to fire a special prosecutor, if he thinks he can do it without suffering significant fallout, he's got the power to do it. So ultimately, it's only the American people who can decide whether the president is above the law.
So you're talking there about, you know, in these other examples, how important public reaction is. I mean, we're only, I guess, about a week into it, but so far from what you've seen, how would you rate the public's reaction to Jeff Sessions being forced out in the particular way that he was?
I think there's been a lot of pushback, some pushback across the political spectrum, although the response from the Republican side has been predictably more muted. I think it's a little bit tough to compare Sessions' ouster with some of the other historical examples because Sessions isn't the special prosecutor. Trump may be proceeding in a tactically savvy way here. At least one possibility is that he's going to proceed step by step, and that's going to make it more difficult for the public to identify any one episode or any one event as the crucial one. So you've seen a lot of people declaring that the firing of Jeff Sessions or the forced resignation of Jeff Sessions was a red line. But I think it's a little bit hard for people to get excited when Robert Mueller still has a job and the new acting attorney general has not taken any obvious public steps to shut down or interfere with the investigation. So I think one of the major challenges for the public going forward is going to be to just keep a really close eye on events and to remain vigilant. In the face of subsequent developments.
So in terms of that red line, one individual who had appeared to set a red line for the ousting of Jeff Sessions was Lindsey Graham, who said there would be holy hell to pay if he got fired. So in terms of, he's obviously backtracked, he doesn't seem to care. And they're pitching it as Jeff Sessions wouldn't work with the president deserves an AG that would work with him. So you have the public reaction, and then you have the potential response from the Democrats and the Republicans. The Republicans seem to not care. Now that the Democrats have taken control of the House, how significant do you think that will be with the future of the Mueller investigation?
Well, I think the midterm elections have the potential to be very significant. At this point, the Mueller investigation has reached a very advanced stage. I think the reason it has reached such an advanced stage is that Trump has been afraid of the political backlash, at least up until the midterms, that he would have triggered by firing or significantly interfering with Mueller's investigation. Now that Mueller has gathered presumably quite a lot of evidence, if the president were to move against him at this point, the Democrats, now that they're in control of the House, have a lot of tools to try to figure out exactly what kind of evidence Mueller gathered and to expose that evidence to public scrutiny.
So you've obviously studied a number of examples where the president would like to just shut this thing down. In some cases, they have done that. Do you believe that the route that Donald Trump will take to avoid that sort of public reaction you've been talking about is that he puts in someone like Whitaker, who's a loyalist and has been, you know, I would say publicly dismissive of this investigation and the basis for it from the beginning. Do you think that it's more likely that they will cut funding, deny requests, you know, keep the final report hidden? Should we expect that sort of strategy?
Well, that's certainly one possibility. I think it's very difficult to make predictions about any investigation of this sort. There are so many variables at play. And of course, in this case, one of those variables is Trump's personality, which is, I think, famously unpredictable. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that you mentioned that we're in this advanced stage in the Mueller report. And I've read at least one report from seemingly inside saying that they're typing up their findings. But we also find out or hear rumors day by day of more indictments potentially coming out. That Corsi, it came out yesterday, is expecting to be indicted. There are reports saying that Don Jr. thinks that he will be indicted as well. Do we think that if those were to happen, does that signal that we might not be as far along in this process as we think that we are?
I think it's very difficult to answer that question because Robert Mueller has played his cards so close to the vest. In contrast to many previous investigations, most notably Ken Starr's special counsel investigation of Bill Clinton, there have been virtually no leaks from inside the Mueller investigation, from Mueller's own team. We've learned a fair number of things over the course of the past year and change, but mostly from people who have had occasion to interact with Mueller or his fellow special prosecutors. And I think that makes it very difficult to venture a guess as to how far along he might be in his investigation. I do think it's quite unsurprising that we've heard nothing from him in the past 2 months or so. That is a reflection of his respect for the norm that federal prosecutors should not take significant action that could affect a political campaign in the months preceding an election. But he may well have been working hard during that time. I think there's every reason to believe that he and his team have been working hard in that time. And it wouldn't be terribly surprising to see some significant developments in the next few weeks now that the midterm elections are behind us.
Well, we wake up every day waiting to see if that will actually happen. Andrew Cohen, professor of law at the University of Arizona, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Amazon has announced where their new headquarters is going to be, and not every politician in that area likes it. We'll describe that after this. Welcome back, everyone. So we've had this big thing. Where is Amazon going to put their new headquarters? And cities all over the country are bidding with each other to throw more taxpayer money at Amazon to get them to relocate, supposedly for the jobs that they'll provide. And we now know where those headquarters are going to be. And it's not in one city, it's actually in two. The two locations, they're in Long Island City in Queens and Crystal City in Arlington near Washington, DC. Those will eventually house at least 25,000 employees each, they say, pre-automation. It also said the new sites would require $5 billion in construction and other investments. So we've got our locations. They're not where I would expect. Generally, these headquarters end up in some, you know, small town where that's even more desperate for the jobs.
Yeah, but all these young millennial workers, you know, they want their kombucha and their, I don't want to say avocado toast because I love avocado toast, but I make it at home. this helped no one. I'm sorry. I mean, unless Crystal City is just barren earth with like, I don't know, an Applebee's, then I don't know who it really helped. I am very surprised by this decision.
A small bit of trivia. I looked up, do you know why it's Crystal City?
Why?
Because the first big building there had a crystal chandelier, and they're very proud of it. And so all of the buildings after that, for a period, were named Crystal Blank. They just really like that chandelier.
So Crystal Amazon.
Crystal Amazon. I agree. The idea is you have all these millennial workers who want to drink their kombucha and then pee into the bottle on their breaks because they can't actually go to the bathroom because it's Amazon. So there are some huge issues. It's one thing to say they're going to get 25,000 jobs. But when you actually look at the sorts of jobs, how much it's going to cost the city, the opportunity cost of giving them all of that money, the gentrification that will result when you bring in all of the execs and everything. I mean, you were talking about so much else, or you could be. They're not actually talking about that. They're just saying, hey, we won, we got Amazon. And now we're gonna give them piles of money. Do you wanna know how much money Amazon is gonna get from this? Just from New York City. So Amazon will qualify for the city's Relocation and Employment Assistance Program, which offers employers a $3,000 credit per employee per year for 12 years if they move their business into the outer boroughs and certain parts of Upper Manhattan. Wow. With Amazon's projected workforce of $25,000, that's $900 million. From that one thing, Amazon put out a statement saying they expect to be given $1.525 billion. Amazon.
In credit, tax credits.
In tax credits. I don't know if you know this, Amazon is the richest company that humanity has ever produced.
The
and we are competing to shovel
store.
Them cash.
It is the Earth's biggest store.
Yes, and look,
we sell you
I like
Earth.
Amazon.
They're gonna sell us to Martians in the future.
Exactly. Look, Amazon does some good things or whatever, and I've ordered.
What,
you don't
want to
know
Post?
How many orders I've done through Amazon.
I well, don't want to know how many.
I've done so many orders. But it is horrendous in terms of the effect it has on the workforce. The way they treat their employees is with greater disdain than potentially any other massive corporation.
But also, it is first of all the cities that didn't win. Very, very sorry. But your roads breathe a sigh of relief because I think even Seattle was one of them, and it was like, oh God, no! Please don't add more traffic to Seattle. Like they can't handle it. But neither can these places. You're right in terms of gentrification, and these places are already incredibly populated. Long Island City, which is kind of one of the, in terms of proximity to Manhattan and like working class or like, you know, still working class neighborhoods, Long Island City is one of those. They're gone. Like it's done after Amazon moves in. I'm from San Francisco. Like I can tell you what techpocalypse looks like. It looks like people riding grown men riding motorized scooters with helmets on the sidewalk. It's hell.
I mean, I like the idea that scooters.
It's
as
hell.
Long as they're electricity through
it
renewable
is,
energy.
It is the most unflattering and disgusting thing.
I want to get a lot of
displacement and a lot of gentrification.
100%. I want to get into the politician that's speaking out of this, but I just want to briefly say, again, it's 25,000 jobs now. That's what they're saying. When has a corporate press release about jobs that will be provided ever been a low estimate? It is always an exaggeration. And by the way, the remaining humans still working for Amazon, their primary task is figuring out how to take humans out of the picture. I read an article about how Amazon has redone how laundry detergent is sold. It's in a totally new package so that it doesn't need to be put in a separate box. It can be like stacked super easily and all that in their truck. Their like efficiency is the only gospel at Amazon, and the human meat bag doesn't actually work in that. It's too expensive. It needs to pee on things. They don't want you. And so they are working overtime to get you not
so
to be on overtime.
There was no good place for the headquarters?
I don't know. The moon, I don't know. It's gonna be all robots eventually, to the extent that it's already not. Look, obviously they have to have a headquarters somewhere, and they're gonna have, there are some people who will get jobs out of this. That is a good thing for them. But I don't know that this is the way to do it. They're paying something like $30,000 per employee. In a lot of these cases, when you look at the numbers, I don't know why the state doesn't just have those people on their payroll themselves.
Right.
Why funnel it through the corporation, which makes a profit, and then gives them the job? In any event, I do want to give credit to-
You mean that's how much the tax break breaks down to, is like
$30,000. It's so much money that they could just have a workforce.
Yeah.
Put them to work. I hear the subway needs some help. okay, let's talk about one of the politicians in the area in Queens who's gonna be affected by this. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you've never heard of her, but she's in that area. And she said that she was talking with residents of Queens, current residents, they'll be pushed out soon. But she said that they have a lot of concerns. And I wanna read a couple of her tweets about this. Amazon is a billion-dollar company. The idea that it will receive hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks at a time when our subway is crumbling and our communities need more investment, not less, is extremely concerning to residents here. Displacement is not community development. Investing in luxury condos is not the same thing as investing in people and families. Shuffling working class people out of a community does not improve their quality of life. We need to focus on good healthcare, living wages, affordable rent. Corporations that offer none of those things should be met with skepticism. It's possible to establish economic partnerships with real opportunities for working families instead of a race to the bottom competition, which is, this is the epitome of a race to the bottom conducted in every community across America. And understand that we're focusing on her, not just because I, you know, like her and admire her as a politician, but because she stands out from other politicians in this exact case in the affected area.
Yeah.
Because both Cuomo and de Blasio, they're ecstatic about this. And their public statements have been that this is amazing. Congrats, New York. Don't focus on all the bad stuff that's gonna come from this. Just give us credit for bringing in jobs hypothetically.
Goodbye, New York. I mean, it really is sad. And I think this, we're gonna see a showdown, you know, with people like AOC and community organizations all around the five boroughs. And versus this, this moneyed techpocalypse, I think that's how I called it. This is goodbye. I mean, if you've been around Manhattan for the last like 10 years, it's changed already. I mean, the traffic is insane. The subways haven't been updated in like 30 years. Like, you know, there's still no air down there. Subway rat, the rats are getting just.
They get pizza from time to time.
Yeah,
that's really
pizza,
it.
Yeah, pizza, man. The rats are like super on Amazon's side. We're gonna call all the rats Bezos, little Jeffies.
You just reminded me. Can I just mention?
Yes, please.
So I saw David Sirota tweeted out. So they have a list of the specific things that New York is gonna subsidize to get the headquarters. New York taxpayers, regular working Americans who ride the subway, are literally subsidizing a helipad for Jeff Bezos.
Of course they are.
And probably a rocket pack too,
but
why not?
That's what I'm saying, if.
Rocket pants.
If, okay, I say if the working people who are going to be displaced and get $3,000, whatever, their employers get $3,000 an employee, if the jetpacks can go to them first, everything's chill.
It would help with traffic.
Yeah, but only for working class people.
Exactly. Yeah, and look, I don't begrudge the people who get their jobs. It's a good thing, but this is by no means the best way that it could be done. And thankfully, we now have politicians who are actually speaking out and reflecting the concerns of their community while that community lasts. Okay, with that said, we are gonna take a break. When we come back, Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ is gonna be joining us. She was at a protest involving Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in DC outside of Nancy Pelosi's office. We'll be breaking that down after this. The halls of Washington, DC got a little bit exciting this morning, and thankfully we're now joined by Emma Vigeland to explain exactly what happened. Emma, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Always glad to have you here, especially when you're involved in breaking news like this. So a protest erupted outside Nancy Pelosi's office. What was it about?
It was about climate change action. I got word last night that I had to head down to DC stat. So this was gonna be a really big deal. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was going to be involved. Rashida Tlaib also getting less press about this, but I saw her do a really emotional speech about the impact of environmental racism on her home state of Michigan. She's obviously a U.S. representative-elect, just like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So protesters had a sit-in at Nancy Pelosi's office, and it begun with them handing Pelosi's secretary letters one by one demanding climate action and saying why climate change was going to affect them, who they were fighting for by protesting. And it ended with arrests of multiple people where a lot of them were, you know, taken away in zip ties, the pretty standard way that Capitol Police get rid of protesters.
So I saw your live interview with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right? We're seeing some of the B-roll right there. I'm assuming that she was not arrested, but did Nancy Pelosi actually come out while you were there, or was it just, you know, hands off, send in the police to cart people out?
No, Nancy Pelosi did not come out. I'm not even sure if she was there. If she was, I would have like bum rushed the other reporters to get an interview with her, because I just have so many questions and opinions. But no, she was not there. It was just her staff and many, many protesters. I was shocked at how many there were and how effectively they kept it under wraps. We were really the first media to know about it, I believe. And then as word got out that AOC was going to show up, a CNN reporter showed up. I saw Breonna Gray-Joy, a fantastic reporter from The Intercept there. So the word got out that it was a big deal. And I'm really lucky that I was able to get there and able to speak to my old buddy, Alexandria. Yeah.
So I assume, I'm not a Michael Shore level political historian, but I'm assuming that Congresswomen elect don't generally protest the potential speaker's office as like the first time they visit that office. Did there seem, when you talked to her, was there any fear of repercussions or strike back or anything like that?
Yeah, by the way, that was my reaction too, John. I was like, oh, they're gonna be sitting down together, right? When I first heard about this, Pelosi and Alexandria, and they're gonna have a nice discussion with the protesters. No, Alexandria or Alex was, you know, a part of the protest in a sense. Most of the protesting happened. She showed up, kind of gave a pep talk, a nice speech to the protesters, and then she spoke to media and left. So it's not like she was there to get arrested. But yeah, I mean, I think she is being as confrontational to the establishment as we can reasonably expect of a representative. She still has to work with Nancy Pelosi at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm seeing on Twitter like, oh, she's getting too cozy with the establishment. Now she's praising Pelosi in some ways. I mean, are you going to treat your coworkers with blatant disrespect and still expect to get anything done? She is being as confrontational and aggressive towards the established order that she can feasibly be as a representative elect from New York.
Hey, Emma, it's Francesca here. I just had a question. Yeah, so can you tell us more about the Sunrise Movement, and also what are they specifically demanding of Nancy Pelosi?
So Sunrise, which I kept accidentally calling Sunshine because I had 4 hours of sleep, are a large environmental group. I covered an action of theirs with which Cynthia Nixon took a part in up in Albany. And that was, you know, them calling on a Democrat again, Andrew Cuomo, to be more aggressive on climate change, where he has been, you know, going back on his promises on fracking, et cetera. But their main goal was to be 100% for the United States to be 100% renewable by 2030. And they were demanding that of Nancy Pelosi. This is based on the United Nations report that said we have very little time to curb the effects of climate change, and there could be cataclysmic consequences. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's platform when she was running for Congress wanted 100% renewable by 2035. So this is even further to the left of Alexandria. In hindsight, I should have asked her if she would update her platform based on the UN report, but yeah, that's really what they were asking, 100% renewable by 2030, and also a Green New Deal, which is investment in the economy so that we can jumpstart clean energy jobs, and the United States can be at the forefront of renewable energy, because right now we're lagging significantly and it's hurting our economy.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that Sunrise throughout that protest is focusing on the benefits of doing this, that it's not just a cost on the economy, but it's an opportunity as well. I wanted to ask you about Pelosi, because I saw that after the protest, she put out a statement. Sam Stein on Twitter said, she said, "I have recommended to my House Democratic colleagues that we reinstate the Select Committee to address the climate crisis." So she had previously done something like this a decade ago. She's very proud of her record on climate change. You know, she had previously had that vote on the the carbon tax. So look, if she thinks that a decade ago she was pretty to the left on this issue, and now the stakes are even higher. I mean, I don't know if you know, Emma, but we're burning right now. Our entire studio is on fire, effectively. How much can we expect out of Nancy Pelosi now with a more progressive House majority, and you know, the stakes obviously being higher?
You know, it's so hard to know what to expect from her, except not to expect much, to be honest with you. I think that a lot of her job is political calculation. How is this going to look? How can I keep the caucus together, et cetera? But you know, what I want from a Speaker of the House, and what I can't speak for you guys, but what I think you want, is someone who's going to lead on these issues, not just be afraid that the blue dog Democrats aren't going to get on board with you. The Democrats, when I look on the DNC website, just say, we want to continue the progress Obama made on climate change, but there's no concrete actual goals for what they want to do. There needs to be a timeline. We need to act now. And that's what the Speaker of the House should be doing if she fully grasped the severity of the issue and wasn't just more concerned about some sort of political game.
Yeah.
And she's been in Washington for a while. That's a lot of the time, that's what they care about.
Yeah, I want to talk, I know this is a little bit outside of the sort of topic of the conversation, but the confrontation, to the extent that it was one, between AOC and Nancy Pelosi today exists in the context of a potential battle over who will actually be the speaker. And I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I mean, Nancy Pelosi can only have so many defections from supporting her. And I know a lot of people support Barbara Lee. As you're talking with these politicians, does it seem like there's gonna be a significant battle?
No, I think Nancy Pelosi is going to be the Speaker of the House, and I don't think it's gonna be super tough for her to regain that control. She calls herself a master legislator, who thinks that should get their head examined. But Barbara Lee is running for party caucus chair, and yeah, she has a lot of momentum behind that. I think that that's setting her up. I mean, she's older, but that sets her up for being Speaker of the House down the line. Once she gets that leadership role, Barbara Lee is one of the greatest progressives in the country and one of the true servants of the people that we have left in the United States Congress. So I would be more than thrilled to see her in leadership and eventually, hopefully, Speaker of the House.
Yeah, I get that strategy. It feels to me like if Nancy Pelosi gets it, she's not giving it up. And it's not like maybe there will be a primary or something. It's not like she's really going anywhere. I think the next person that's going to get it is going to be like House Speaker Louie Gohmert if the Republicans retake the House.
But like, how crazy is it? Sorry, John, to interrupt you, but Nancy Pelosi's approval rating is atrocious. It's not politically expedient for the Democrats to have her as Speaker of the House, but because they're all friends, it's just like, well, we'll go with her again.
Yeah.
She's toxic politically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I could think of a few examples that I would probably prefer. In any event, I wish we had more time, Emma, but we do have to go. Thank you so much both for your work this morning and then for joining us to break it down.
Thanks, John. Thanks. Bye, Francesca.
Bye.
Okay, short break. When we come back, I want to talk about your new podcast,
yeah,
The Bituation Room, and potentially some more after this. Welcome back to What Remains of the Damage Report. Just got done with Emma Vigeland. And I know that we said this at the break, but she's awesome.
She's great.
I wish we could clone her and send many Emmas all over the country to interview reporters. Have you seen
they
her?
They do that with horses.
They do? Yeah, you need consent. So have you seen her Trump rally interviews?
Yes, those are great.
I don't know how she does it.
I don't know how she
Have you talked with Trump supporters in that way?
Some. But
I talked to some, but I can't do the straight-faced thing that she does.
No.
She don't
can see
play
her
poker
like there's
her.
Like a little mini blink of like that was all lies.
Yeah, she's dying inside.
Yeah.
But she keeps it together on the outside. So she's awesome, but you're awesome too. And I want to talk about a new way that you can witness Francesca being awesome in audio form at the very least.
Yes.
You have a new podcast.
I do. It's called The Bituation Room. Mm-hmm. It comes out every Monday. And it is
awesome. You've got 6 episodes, I believe, at this point.
6 episodes already. This last episode, talking about obviously the midterms and our just little pissy POTUS that we have, who's just in a tear ever since. And it's fun. It's with me and a comedian and an expert or activist. So we've had Josh.
So you always have the comedian.
Always a comedian.
With you, and
always
then
an activist or an expert. Josh Fox of Gasland 1 and 2 was on. Shane Bauer, the journalist, was on. Matt Lieb, the comedian from News Broke, was also on. And Corinda Dobbins, Nato Green, all these other wonderful people. And yeah, so definitely tune into that. We have fun. It's important.
Yeah,
to
it's a sort of casual, chatty, but serious and substantive talk.
Precisely. I think it's important to take ourselves less seriously. I've always believed that as while we can be very heated and like not miss this moment, you know, we have to like chillax. We have to make sure that the left is chill and fun.
and we are more fun, I would say.
Yeah, well, I'm a page chill. So
exactly. So you know how to chill.
I do know how to chill. Every episode, we have we ask our people, our panelists, what they're bitching about, and then we go into one the sitch of the week. Then we go into a targeted character assassination, what I like to call a targeted character assassination, not like CIA assassinations. So this week, of course, it was Whitaker. Matt Whitaker?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just looking at him trying to hawk like one of the patented products that actually wasn't patented because the company that he was on the board of has been fined like $26 million.
Is that the vet thing?
Yes, that ripped off mostly vets. He's
wonderful.
Got a cute little Vimeo video where he's actually trying to like sell you on this new product that like, you know, the world patent system or whatever the company was called was hawking. And it's just a razor. It's like a razor in a pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know when you like need a razor in the kitchen? You're like, no.
No.
Nobody needs a razor in the kitchen.
I think he's using a Gillette to like take the skin off apples.
Exactly.
And that's a weird thing.
Yeah, or like, you know when you make a salad and you just put like razor blades in it because like the wife's been uppity? What? No.
He didn't say that, did he?
No. What I'm saying is the guy, you know, the whole thing was just like snake oil salesman, but not even. They just rip people off. And then we end every show with a game called Sext, Elect, Overthrow, which is really fun. Can we play like a quick version right now?
Okay, we only have 2 minutes, but what?
Okay, so this week, Sext, Elect, Overthrow, we chose the 3 women who have consensually submitted to Donald Trump.
Okay.
So that we know of, Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal, and Melania Trump. Sext, Elect, Overthrow. I think
that's easy. I would sext Karen McDougal. I don't know much about her, but I'm sure she could dish out some good texts.
Sure.
I would elect Stormy Daniels because I don't know her politics really, but she's a fighter, and let's get more of that. And Melania is due for an overthrowing, and I bet she would be like one of those wives of the dictators that when she is dragged out of the presidential palace, she'll be in a fabulous outfit.
Oh, and she'll be just like gripping one vase, like, let me keep this.
My paintings. That's a good game, I like it.
Yeah, it's fun, and I'll have you on, right? You're coming on?
Awesome, but I'm not an activist or an expert, so you're gonna have to.
No, you're an expert.
Widen
you're a journalist.
Something like that.
You're a journalist.
I play one on YouTube TV.
You do.
Okay, and so let's say, just hypothetically, I play a game with you. If you could choose, who is the perfect guest that you'd want on the show?
The perfect guest?
If you could have one guest, who would it be?
I mean, we've said her name many times. I feel like if I say it
Karen
again.
Karen McDougal. Who would it be?
Karen, if you're listening.
Would it be
Alexandria? Karen McDougal.
Yeah?
I want to just have like a deep chat with her and just be like, you really thought he was in love with you?
Oh, God.
Really?
I don't know.
He had a 3-month-old child.
That's true.
Fed on.
That's true. So
I want AOC?
AOC
on, of course.
Okay, we're going to have to end on that, unfortunately. But thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
Check out the Bituation Room. Thank you for watching this one as well. And we'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.